From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The editors of the food magazine Lucky Peach have labeled their latest edition the American food issue, though they admit they've left a lot of stuff out. Hey, America is a big place with lots of different people from all over the world. Editor Chris Ying says they started out trying to cover as much as they could, but it wasn't long before they realized there's just no way you could paint a comprehensive portrait of American food. So what they've done is get at a cross-section of what there is to eat in America, and today in the program we're talking about it. There's this question they work through in the magazine, just what does anyone mean by American food? Is it regional? Is it ethnic? Is it the food mom made? Or is it really about food at all and rather about circumstance and people? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the creators of the food magazine Lucky Peach are back with us. We're talking about their latest issue, which they're calling the American Food Issue. Early on in the magazine, there's this piece that includes an interview by the writer and editor Peter Meehan and these acclaimed restaurant writers, and we'll talk about it today. But the idea was for Peter to get at the question of the state of American cuisine. So throughout the piece, he makes various attempts at getting them to talk about it, but ultimately they just go off on these digressions, which are really funny and interesting, but don't really come to any conclusions about American food. And it is hard to nail down American food. So today in the program, we'll do what they've done at Lucky Peach, just talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook and on Twitter. Maybe this is the question, just what is it that makes food American? Chris Ying is joining us. He's the editor-in-chief of Lucky Peach, and Peter Meehan, the co-editor. They're both joining us today from the studios of NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. And Chris and Peter, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Doug.
We should also mention that the newest issue is now available on newsstands. So, I wanted to start with the little dig that David Chang makes in the little editorial thing at the top of the magazine, where he's sort of chiding you for this is how he puts it: he couldn't get you to open your hearts to some other regions. And I'm guessing he's only kind of kidding, but it does sort of make me realize how difficult it must have been to try to cover American food. I mean, cover the whole country.
Well, I don't know if we actually set out, you know, to cover the whole country, yeah. But it's hard when you're even at 174 pages in the magazine, you know, there's no way you can get close to touching on everything. And I'm from Chicago originally, and there's nothing about Chicago food, which was my definition of American food for the first 18 years of my life. So it became kind of a running joke about who we were excluding, you know, because we have something on the Ojibwe Indians, mm-hmm. but we have nothing on Chicago hot dogs. So, you know, you're always going to be leaving somebody out.
So what is it that when you first started putting it together, what is it you wanted to, you know, get at? I mean, it was the American food issue, but did you even know what that meant when you started?
Well, the idea for the issue came to us from this chef, Daniel Patterson, out here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And you know, he said to us one day after the third issue, I think, had come out and we had been sort of at a loss, which we often are, as to what we're going to talk about next. He said, why don't you cover American food? And really the entire magazine was the conversation that followed, which is, what does that even mean? What is that, you know, how can we cover American food? And just the difficulty we had from the very beginning pinning down what that meant or what that was or how we could cover every ethno-geographic region and group. Became the sort of crux of the whole thing.
Yeah, the unanswerableness of that question, the fact that you're doomed to failure and to making people feel like, well, doesn't my cuisine matter? Yeah. You know, was like, oh, this is a perfect, you know, pot of boiling water to jump into. Let's do that.
This is also the sort of postmodern explanation that people give for things when they have no idea actually how to
exactly. Or have done a poor job at doing it.
Right. Of course, we were trying to base the magazine around a question. That's that was the whole idea.
That's right.
Certainly.
Well, so I guess this is sort of what you were trying to do when you got Jonathan Gold and Robert Sietsamus together.
Sietsma and Gold are both they're both heroes of mine. So it was also just a chance for me to kidnap the two of them and get to hang out with them for 3 days. I don't want to make it sound any more noble than what it really was. But in 25 years of you know, for Jonathan, he's been writing about restaurants since I think about 85 and Robert since 93. You know, I feel like both of them have done great jobs writing about immigrant cuisine, you know, about people arriving to America and starting small ethnic restaurants and bringing new foods to this country that become part of the story of American cuisine. So I thought it would be cool to explore it with them and maybe look at it a little bit more through that angle than trying to just find the archetypal red, white, and blue American food. But then to counter that, we went to Kansas City, which is, you know, the bullseye center of America and about as red, white, and blue as you can get.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about making the decision to go to Kansas. It was – and you refer to this essay written by Calvin Trillin back in 1974, I think it was, which, Peter, you say in the piece that it really kind of changed the conversation that we were having about food in the country.
You know, I think it did, and I'm afraid of pronouncements like that, but I know for me when I read that essay that was later the opening essay of the Tummy Trilogy, the collection of Trillin's first three food books, the idea that, you know, I forget the phrase offhand, I don't have the magazine in front of me, but the Maison de la Casa House defined continental cuisine, the idea that the fanciest restaurant in town is the best restaurant in town. And then what Trillin worked to do was kind of debunk that and praise barbecue, praise the regional food, fried chicken that was there in Kansas City. I think that was, you know, not unprecedented. There are certainly writers who are writing about, you know, the everyday quotidian food of America before that. But Trillin did it in The New Yorker and I think made it okay to talk about, you know, barbecue as being as important as, you know, what somebody in a starched chef jacket is sending out. Mm. And I feel like Jonathan and Robert are kind of the inherited that from Trillin. And so I was interested to see where they took that and how, you know, and kind of followed that line of thought. And it's fascinating to see it going from talking about the everyday American foods like fried chicken and barbecue to talking about banh mi's in Orange County and Northern Chinese food, you know, that's come to New York City. And how that is now, that's American food, and that's part of the discussion about American food. So it was kind of trying to pick up where Trillin put it and see where these guys had taken it to today.
I wondered, have you ever, because I've often wondered what it would be like to drive around with Jonathan Gold. And for those who aren't familiar with his writing, I mean, he's, you know, he writes now for the Los Angeles Times, I guess. He's written for the LA Weekly and Gourmet, and he not so long ago won a Pulitzer for his food writing. And he's kind of famous for these journeys where he gets in his pickup truck, I guess it is, and travels throughout Los Angeles finding all sorts of kind of obscure and amazing places to eat. Have you ever been with him? And
Eaten around. I'd never met Jonathan. I met him at the airport in Kansas City. And basically this is my chance to get to go and eat with Jonathan. But yeah. Jonathan and Robert, I can eat a lot. I feel like I'm a very good eater. But those guys, you know, we started at 10 o'clock in the morning and there was no stopping. There was no delay. You know, it's like finish a plate of ribs. It's like, should we go to the fried chicken place? Yeah, let's go. Wow. You know, should we go to the donut place? Yeah, let's go. Should we go to another barbecue place? Yeah, let's go. I heard there's a fancy new restaurant that's not that good. Let's go there and have appetizers. You know, and it was just like one place. I think we ate – I was compiling the receipts afterwards and – I mean, we didn't eat an expensive – we didn't spend more than $60 or $70 on a meal in 2.5 days in Kansas City, and we spent $780 eating. So we just – I mean, we just really – you know, so it's – but it's not about gluttony. It's really about hunger for experience and knowledge and looking at things. So – and the two of them are old friends. They've known each other since the 90s. So getting them to bicker and go back and forth a little bit, as like kind of a youngish food writing person, it was really exciting experience for me to get to watched those guys work. And now I've since gone and hung out with Jonathan in L.A., and he's one of the brightest guys I've ever met. He knows more about, you know, he knows so much about culture outside of food, and I think that's why he does such a great job contextualizing what he's eating, because he's not saying, like, this appetizer is good, that entree is bad, order this. You know, it's not service writing he does. You know, it's something I think we talked about in the piece, but both of those guys don't feel like they're writing about food. They're writing about, you know, eating in the context that it happens in.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I loved the fact that he likes the jalapeno poppers at Jack in the Box, too.
Totally.
You know, that he's completely down to earth about his food. And so, but did when you're eating with him, does he break it down in a certain way? I mean, does he taste it in a certain way? I mean, do you have any sense of how it works?
I mean, I do not know what happens inside that brain. Sietsma was actually much more of the he would bite into something and start rattling off spices and, like, particular flavors, yeah, and trying to, you know, hone in on what was in a rub or what was in a sauce or what was going on. I mean, I think he was much more the immediately articulating what he was experiencing and trying to figure out. Jonathan is a little bit more of a, you know, quiet, brooding, Buddha-like presence at, yeah, the table, and then has little short, you know, oracular pronouncements that he makes about it after he's eaten.
I wanted to ask you about something where you're talking to Jonathan, and he mentions how traditional restaurants and traditional cuisine, and he figures that in Los Angeles, they're better than the ones in New York, because he thinks that there's, as he says it in the interview, there's this insularity in Los Angeles, you know, with these huge neighborhoods of one particular ethnic group, where in New York it's harder to be isolated. Do you think he's got a point?
Yes. I think he's – I mean, you know, in matters of taste, I guess there's – you know, you could – people will continue to argue endlessly about, you know, ethnic food in New York versus – or, you know, traditional food in New York versus traditional food in – Los Angeles. But I think the size of the enclaves and the fact that the you know, it's in New York, it might be a neighborhood, but that's, you know, maybe 20 square blocks, as where in Los Angeles, it feels like small cities right next to each other. So, yeah, there really are whole communities that support themselves and have all the services that they need. And, you know, I think that there's a very compelling argument to make from that to them being able to really focus and serve food that's more closely related to the tradition that the food comes from.
You guys didn't really get it, or you may have, but you didn't include it in the piece. But the, you know, that question which comes up, the idea of what's authentic, you know, what's authentically ethnic, or what's authentically, you know, from a particular region. What do you guys make of that of that question? And what do you think Robert or Jonathan make of that idea of what's actually real or authentic?
In Lucky Peach 1, we addressed a writer named Todd Kleiman from Washington wrote an essay about authenticity. And I think it's a party line at Lucky Peach or something, a belief we all share. But there's when people talk about going to eat an authentic restaurant, like, oh, it's full of Chinese people, it must be authentic. You know, it's not – authentic isn't a good barometer to judge whether or not food is going to be bad. Food might be prepared traditionally. It might be a traditional menu and they're preparing traditional dishes. But the quantifying the authenticity, I think, is kind of a game that doesn't really prove anything. I mean, Chris, you have, you know, we've talked about this endlessly.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of friends of ours who run, like, the most popular but least authentic Chinese restaurant in New York, Mission Chinese Food right now, talk about, like, the idea of authenticity often, and I think they sort of sum it up really well in saying that, you know, the food they're serving is by no means authentically Chinese. They're not trying to recreate any dishes of the Imperial Palace, but they're trying to create this authenticity of experience, which is something that I think that Jonathan and Robert try to get to all the time, which is regardless of how accurately a restaurant is, you know, making a donut or whatever, the idea of, like, sitting and eating is in itself the entire point. So, like, yeah, you may not be in the most authentic Italian or Chinese restaurant, but so long as like you're authentically there and like eating and having like a good experience, like that's all you really should be looking for.
Yeah. I found the conversation that Peter, you had with Jonathan interesting when you'd mentioned at some point that the ribs that you were eating, like you weren't crazy about them, that they didn't work for you. I can't remember, they were too dry or too mushy or something like that. And Jonathan says, you know, that you were talking about it wrong, like that they hadn't blown it, but it just
right.
wasn't
we
your aesthetic, I think it was how he put it.
Yeah, we were at a barbecue place, and I thought the ribs were too soft, you know, like they were just coming away from the bone too. They weren't, they you know, I didn't like, and I was kind of just speaking ill of the ribs, and it was, you know, I wrote restaurant reviews for the New York Times mm-hmm. for a little bit, and there is been fewer greater pleasures in my professional life than getting my wrist slapped by Jonathan Gold while at a barbecue restaurant in Kansas City. Because right. he's like, no, it's not that this isn't your aesthetic, but they were really beautiful ribs. I mean, it was the most gorgeous slab of ribs that's ever been laid down in front of me. And he's like, this is their aesthetic. This is what they're doing. Like you have to, you know, you can judge this on its own merits and then you can judge how you like it. But you have to compartmentalize those things just because it doesn't match my ideal of rib perfection doesn't mean that they're not doing, you know, and I think that separating yourself, understanding the context, deciding where those two things match up and matter, you know, that's the work you need to do as a restaurant critic, you know, and I guess I'm enough years out of the game that I wasn't thinking about it sitting with those guys. But I think that that's one of the things that both Jonathan and Robert do really well is that they will judge a restaurant in its own context and figure out what that context is and then, you know, assess apart from that. And that was, you know, and I just wanted to put that in because it was great to see that at work while eating with those two guys.
Yeah. There's that great anecdote that Jonathan talks about where, you know, I think somebody asked him, you asked him maybe like, or Robert asked him like, what is the most number of times that you had been to a restaurant? I think he was like, 15, it was the worst restaurant I'd ever been to, and I couldn't understand it, so I just kept going and going and going.
He went to, a Chinese restaurant he hated 17 times, and he never ended up liking the food, but he got to the point where he understood the food and understood the, you know, the cuisine that it was coming from in, you know, in China. And that's the work that, you know, that's the reason he's Jonathan Gold and everybody else isn't.
Well, because, it goes 17 times, finally, and it's pretty popular. I mean, somebody's liking it, and it wasn't that he couldn't figure out why they weren't liking it, but he wasn't understanding it.
He wasn't connecting to it, and he just went until he got his head around it. I think that's, you know, that's admirable, and that's work that, you know, most people, all people writing about food, you know, tend not to put into it, but that is one of the things that makes him, you know, such a special and important writer, and why it was like so great to get to kidnap him and bring him to Kansas City.
Chris, there's this piece that you kind of helped orchestrate with Courtney McBroom and Allison Roman, and the idea was to sort of find the best Mexican American cuisine, I guess, in the Southwest. And we don't need to say too much about the piece. I think people should read it because it's really fun to go through it. It's kind of a you let the reader kind of have a part in the journey. But near the end of it all, you all go to this place that's a favorite of Allison's father. It's a place called Tito's Tacos, I guess it is. They do anyway. And the tacos they're not that great. I mean, they seem kind of ordinary in some ways, but they're really familiar for Allison. Or is it Courtney? I can't remember which, but there's kind of the idea is that there's nostalgia here and good company that are as important really as the quality of that of the food, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, sort of at the center of that piece was this debate that Courtney and Allison were having and had been having for months and years in New York about whether California style tacos, which are, you know, these simply adorned, probably more authentically Mexican tacos.
White flour corn tortilla or white corn tortillas.
Tortilla. Yeah, just like
simple garnishes.
Like street,
versus
like
Texas
street tacos.
Taco.
Yeah, yeah.
Like street tacos, exactly. Yeah. Versus, you know, a Texas taco, which is a little bit more of this hybridized creation, like a crispy taco shell mounded with sour cream and ground beef and just, you know, tons of nuclear orange cheese. Which one of those was better? And, you know, like this is sort of this debate that they have throughout this piece. But then sitting in L.A. in, you know, the sort of heart of Allison's hometown is this restaurant Tito's that does these Texas-style cheesy, beefy tacos. And, you know, the debate just went out the door because this is where Allison had gone as a kid. And, like, this is – she was sitting there with her family and, you know, Courtney was there. And it kind of gets at what we were talking about earlier where the question of what's authentic or what's better and, you know, is it better to have a more authentic taco or burrito or whatever doesn't really matter. It's just about that authenticity experience.
And I think there's something connecting that end story of the taco piece and something Jonathan said in the piece I did with him, which is nostalgia. And I feel like that's like kind of the secret theme of the issue is that so much of American cuisine is about nostalgia for what we, you know, what we have or what we grew up with or what we knew. And we didn't set out to write like nostalgia-filled food magazine number 4, but so many of the stories ended up going there. And to me, when I looked at it then, I'm like, man, this is the nostalgia issue.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because Jonathan talks about how this idea of nostalgia, it's like he said, this idea of comfort food started in the 80s when people were, you know, longing for the food that mom supposedly made. But he says the problem was mom usually wasn't a really good cook. And so the idea of nostalgia was in some ways kind of food that didn't really exist, maybe not necessarily, but that we kind of figured did, or our idea about the way it's supposed to be, I guess.
Right, that the you know, the processed foods revolution of the mid-century created the, you know, a lot of the homemaker cuisine that people grew up with. And then by the 80s, they were nostalgic for something that was, you know, an industrialized version of what had come before. But that became our ideal of what, you know, the apple pie became a different thing by the 1980s than it must have been in the 1940s. So that's a, you know, it's a real thing that had changed in American cuisine.
Peter Meehan is with us. Chris Ying, also editor-in-chief. Chris is editor-in-chief. Peter is co-editor of Lucky Peach. The newest issue is now available on newsstands. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuwr.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUWR and Sirius XM Public Radio. Go, 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 go. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the editors of the food magazine Lucky Peach are back with us. We're talking about the fourth issue of the magazine. It's the American food issue. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuwr.org. So I wanted to talk about some of the other pieces in the magazine. You mentioned Richard Parks, who goes goes to Cambodia to... Well, talk about it, I guess. I mean, he's trying to figure out why so many Cambodian people in the United States own donut shops. And so he – and in fact, it turns out like 90% of all independent donut shops are owned by Cambodians.
In California, right?
In California.
Like California donuts are
– which, funnily enough, Jonathan Gold had also already
covered. Well, of course Jonathan Gold knew about it because
of course.
it's
– Right. That's in his wheelhouse.
All knowledge passes through, but – But yeah, Richard, I mean, you and Richard worked on that story, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, that entire story came about because, and this is sort of indicative of how Lucky Peach comes together generally, for the squeamish, you know, this is a little bit about how the sausage is made, in case you want to stop listening. But Richard was already going to Cambodia, and he asked if I would like him to do something for Lucky Peach. And I thought the phrase Comerican food was funny. And so not knowing whether anything would come of it, we decided to assign the Comerican food story. And so he went to Cambodia trying to find, you know, parallels between the food in Cambodia and Cambodian food in America. Or he tried to find American restaurants in Cambodia to see if they would, how they, you know, what kind of resemblance they bore to the American food here, and, you know, sort of failed on both fronts. Like, didn't have anything intelligent or interesting to say. Not Richard is an intelligent man, but didn't have anything interesting to say, or didn't find anything particularly profound about American food in Cambodia or Cambodian food in America, until he was walking around his neighborhood and sort of realized that his neighborhood back in Oakland, California, and realized that all of the donut shops, and I think there are three or four within a mile of his house, were all run by Cambodian refugees from the Khmer Rouge atrocities. And that led down this sort of rabbit hole of the article.
Yeah,
and exploring how, you know, there was one refugee who came and, you know, started working at a donut shop and started to build a donut empire. And then as more people came looking for work, you know, that was the way in. And now...
Yeah, and it's sort of, I think that is the story of a lot, you know, there's a lot of these questions about how, you know, so many Cambodians came to run donut shops, or however many... I'm going to try to sidestep being racist here in some way.
How many Greek families, for example, in Salt Lake City own charbroiled hamburger restaurants, for example, which I always find really interesting.
Sure. And it seems like the story is that, you know, one person starts it, of course. You know, it's like the patient zero. And then when a family member or a family friend then immigrates to America and they're looking for something to do, they talk to this person and they work in his shop. And eventually they say, hey, you know, this is a profitable business. And it really, and then eventually somebody wisens up and says, you know, I'm going to be in the supply chain. I'm going to make the donut fryers, and I'm going to cater to all of the Cambodians. And it really is, you know, and part of Richard's piece is he thought, like, is there some sort of Cambodian antecedent to the donut? Is there some kind of like prehistoric Cambodian Khmer donut that like I can find and say like, oh, the reason why everyone loves donuts here is because, like, this chocolate glazed Cambodian donut is extremely popular in Cambodia. But it's just not true. They don't like donuts. They think they're too sweet. You know, the Cambodian people who run the donut shops in America would prefer if their kids wouldn't eat so many sugary donuts. It really has to do with just that kind of like spirit of coming here, looking for work, and then, you know, sharing your knowledge with the people who come next.
And I think there's something to be said for, like, you know, the inability to cover all of America, but you find a story like this and, you know, without general, but it does have echoes, like you said, in charbroiled burger restaurants and Greek immigrants in Utah. But I think that so many, you know, things across the country probably happened the same way. One person came in and they, you know, and the connections that they had led to being in these parts of the food service industry, because it is a, there's a pretty low barrier to entry to work in cooking and serving food. And it's a, you know, it creates a possibility of employment and, you know, setting up something for your family and your relatives to work in. And I think this was, you know, picking one prism to look at that story through. Plus, how often do you read about Cambodians in food magazines? I mean,
this is what's great about the magazine, though, guys, is you guys are all over the map. And in the good, you know, in the good way, like talk about whose idea was the Andy Warhol piece?
That's Peter.
So there's a big theme in the issue is the movie Diner.
Yeah.
We did a huge recipe package around it. We have some film writing about it, and it's one of Chang's favorite, Dave Chang, our co-editor, one of his favorite movies. And I watched it and I hated it. But I decided we would work on it anyways, because why not? You know, that's, you know, it's a good challenge. And but I was at the time, my wife showed me this movie called Andy Warhol Eats a Hamburger. It's a 7-minute film. You can find it online of Andy Warhol eating a hamburger. You know, it's just that. And I'm like, I'm going to write about this as an antidote to the sentimental nature of Diner. I'm just going to write about what it's like to watch a man eat a hamburger. And then I talked to my friend Bob Nickus, who's a fantastic art writer. He's got a book called Theft is Vision that I think is absolutely brilliant. He edited Art Forum for a long time. And I brought it up with Bob. I'm like, is this trite? Has this been done a lot before? Is this something that's been discussed? And it just came about that Bob was willing to tackle Andy Warhol and food. He just sent me back such a better idea and so much more information about Andy Warhol's relationship with food, then I'm like, why don't you write about Andy Warhol and food, and we'll have that in there. And Bob, you know, just took off and went on it. I mean, he's been an art, you know, art writer and curator for a long time, and he turned in that piece, and I thought it was fantastic, and we got to run it in there.
Well, he writes about how the pop artists who really took hold after World War II, you know, Lichtenstein and Jasper Johns and, you know, guys like Andy Warhol were all children of the Great Depression.
And I think, you know, I think it's one of the great things when we, you know, when we run into the right collaborators that you have a, you know, I have a dumb idea about writing about Andy Warhol eating a hamburger. And then Bob was able to take it to this whole other place and talk about the relationship that artists had to food who were of that generation,
yeah,
because there was, you know, deprivation in their youth. So the imagery that they created of food, you know, there's this whole other association with it. And it, you know, it, I don't know, it's a piece of depth and complexity that I could have never, you know, pulled out because I'm really more of a guy who writes about eating burritos. So, yeah, he talked about that, about how, you know, Warhol came, you know, his relationship to food was probably founded in the fact that he grew up in the Great Depression. And then throughout life, he had this, I don't know, kind of an arm's length relationship to it. And yeah, even as he got, you know, he was famous for being famous. He was famous for being successful. And he would have these, you know, lavish meals at the most expensive, most, you know, high-end restaurants like La Grenouille in New York. And then he would have them wrap up all of the food that he had, and he would leave it on the street corner for somebody to find. And in the philosophy of Andy Warhol, he writes about not like it's a great act of charity on his part, but whether or not some guy on the street would find his leftovers and think like, oh, man, why did they order that? So, you know, yeah, constantly questioning the relationship between food and the person who eats it. So, I mean, I think it's a great think piece about Andy Warhol and food and, you know, throughout his career.
You know, going back to Diner, you have Anthony Bourdain and the critic Elvis Mitchell talking about how food is portrayed in movies, and they're not really that impressed with the way food is mostly portrayed in movies. I mean, Mitchell talks about how commercials make food look better than it is, and talks about how movies rarely pull it off very well. What do you think? I mean, what's the problem with the way food really is conveyed, do you think, in movies?
I mean, I think that food is not unique in that way. I think that most people, if you see your profession or your, you know, your area of expertise portrayed in film, you're always going to have some problem.
Right,
with
I bet
it.
Knitters are pissed.
Knitters are
the way
so angry.
Portrayed in movies.
Or, you know, vampires these days must be so upset about how they're being portrayed as these pasty.
Like, we don't use that much eyeshadow.
Right. But, you know, that aside, it does seem like food is particularly savaged when it comes to its on-screen portrayal. And, it, you know, maybe it's just that when you're shooting at 2 a.m. and it's the 51st take, the pizza you ordered at 2 p.m. for the scene just doesn't look as good.
Well, I think Elvis talks about it a little bit in his piece about food in Tarantino's movies. And Brian Koppelman touches on it in – who's a screenwriter who wrote a piece about Diner for us talks about what, you know, nothing is happening when you're eating, and movies are, you know, televised, you know, filmed entertainment is about action. So when food is the centerpiece of a scene, it slows time in a movie, and it really has to become about, you know, what's happening over that, and to integrate the food into that scene takes, you know, it's an act of art to make it integral and not just make it a setting where people can sit down and talk about something and you can advance the plot a little bit. So it's not the easiest thing to make food a natural, appealing part of something, you know, and then you have the, you know, the far ends of that, like Ramen Girl with Brittany Murphy, where there's like the slow-mo noodle shaking scene where they're making a bowl of ramen, you know. So there's like a very short distance in between parody and utility. And I think that finding the places where, you know, they actually make art out of it is it's difficult to do in the medium.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that Elvis talks about it is in the context of Tarantino films, and he also talks about, I think, Soderbergh and like Ocean's 11, and, and just food is best used when it's, and the only way it can feel natural is when it's in the background or it's something that just happens to be going on while other things are happening. You know, the most boring dinners are when you just sit across from your dining partner and just stare at your plate and eat. You know, it's like a dinner is exciting to be involved in when you're having a conversation and you happen to be taking bites of food between interesting bits of conversation. And I think that if you're not going to make food, you know, hit people on the head with it as a central metaphor, like a ramen girl, or like, or in a positive way, like eat, drink, man, woman,
or, you know, or use it like Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction when he's like, can I have a bite of your hamburger? And it's a clear demonstration of power and dominion that he's eating this man's, you know, I'm going to drink your milkshake. Like, that's a, you know,
short of actually going, you know, really putting it at the center, you know, it's hard to
put it to occupy any other space in the medium.
It's funny because it was weird. I was actually watching Goodfellas last night. And the part, you know, the part where he's shaving the, Paulie is shaving the garlic with a razor blade.
Razor blade in prison.
Yeah. I love
that. Such an impression on me. Yeah. Or, you know, at the end when it's all falling apart and Ray Liotta's like trying to go out and he's
making
like
the sauce.
His cousin, like, don't forget to stir the sauce. You know, like that's the cops are coming. Helicopters are closing in. Don't forget to stir the sauce. Yeah. And that's, and those are points where food becomes poignant and, you know, and has a role that's greater than just being, you know, a crappy-looking pizza sitting on the table.
Peter Meehan is with us, co-editor of Lucky Peach magazine. Chris Ying, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, they are joining us today to talk about the American food issue. It's the fourth issue of Lucky Peach, and we need to take another break. So we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Chris Ying and Peter Meehan, the editors of the magazine Lucky Peach. We're talking about the latest issue, the American food issue. So say something about Jonathan Prince's piece, if you would. He's this veteran political operative guy, and he's writing about kind of the relationship, I guess, or the connection between eating and food and politics and democracy, I guess.
Yeah, Jonathan wrote a piece called Photo Op Food, and, you know, he touches on a thing that other writers have also noticed, and Jonathan has worked on several campaigns, the Edwards campaign and
Clinton's
campaign, and, you know, one of the classic photo ops for somebody running for political office is the state fair, eating something greasy. I'm a down home kind of guy, you know, and there are examples of it throughout American political history. And it continues, like, no matter how many miserable failures there are, no matter how many horrible pictures of Michelle Bachmann there are eating a corn dog, people continue to go to that well. And, you know, Jonathan wrote a really funny piece that mixed a lot of those sort of images that we've seen with some nice behind the scenes stuff of what these guys are eating when the cameras are ostensibly off.
You know, right.
They're still eating fried chicken.
It's so interesting how the president got a lot of crap. I think it was like last week for eating an ice cream cone with a spoon. I don't know if you guys saw that. But
everybody eats ice cream cones with spoons.
I do it with a fork and a knife. And things, you know. And that's actually a funny, like, classic trope is, like, when the way you eat something that is down home betrays, you know, the reality of it. Like,
there's a story about McGovern, I think, eating a tamale and not taking the corn husk off.
Yeah, just biting into the outer wrapping, you know, which is like eating a burrito with the foil still on.
Or John Kerry going to Philadelphia and ordering a cheese stick with Gruyere?
With just Swiss cheese.
Oh, Swiss, sorry. Okay, I'm making him sound
Emmentaler.
You made it worse.
Even, yeah.
Right.
But, I mean, what's the idea?
That's how I order it.
Yeah. The idea is what? That a photo op is intended to sort of convey that you're really an American. in the way you
eat. Yeah, and it's, you know, our local food, you know, it's part of the lingua franca. It's part of what, you know, like earlier, I'm from Chicago, and the way you eat, you know, when you order ketchup on your hot dog in Chicago, like you, I mean, some places won't even give it to you that way, but it's not how it's done. You're doing it the wrong way. Like, you are possibly under five. I don't know. No one understands. So it's one of these things where, you know, these guys who are from one place and probably went to an Ivy League school and, you know, spend all their time in Washington are going to go out and go through the countryside and court votes and eat, you know, every man's food. And then they just have a really high batting average of managing to do that wrong. So, I mean, it's kind of humorous, but it also looks at the connection they're trying to make and the message that they're trying to send about themselves and how food is one of the, you know, especially in campaigning, like, primary ways to do it, because you can take a picture and be like, hey, that's the guy who wants to be president. He's at our local fried pork sandwich stand. Like, he's one of us.
Yeah.
You know, that's the message they're trying to put out, and there's humor to extract in how often people get that wrong.
I wanted to ask you about Mark Maron, who's a stand-up comic, and he hosts a really great podcast called WTF. People are familiar, and he wrote this essay on how you care for, or, well, it's even more than that, a cast iron skillet. Talk about that piece, would you?
Mark Maron found a cast iron pan at a garage sale, I think, in San Francisco. And, you know, the woman who sold it to him for, I think, $7, $5, 35 cents or something really low, made this great point that, you know, if you take this pan, you have to care for it. You have to promise me, you have to swear to me that you'll take care of this pan for the rest of your life, its life, whatever. You know, it's like a cryptic beginning to like a Gremlins movie or something. Like, don't feed this after midnight. But, you know, and he took it very seriously. As you should.
Yeah.
And it sort of became this obsession with him that
because they multiply if you feed them after that.
They multiply. And if you get them wet, they become gremlins. Which you actually, it's a good advice for a cast iron pan too. Don't get it wet. You know, he started realizing that whenever, you know, his professional life was tanking or his love life was less than, you know, savory, he would turn to this pan and just, you know, add another layer of oil and bake it on and then clean it over and over methodically and, you know, build. And that's how cast iron pans work, is you just continually build this layer, you season the pans. And, you know, I won't like totally spoil.
Maybe you shouldn't. I was going to go into that part, but it's funny how it becomes part of his identity, you know, in some ways, or at least he sees it as a symbol that way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a pretty overt thing, you know, just with each passing tragedy or mishap in his life, he just paints on another layer onto this seasoned pan, you know, and we won't hit you over the head with it. But yeah, it's a sort of this beautiful little thing that such a quotidian act is what he turns to whenever times is tough.
So, Chris, you want to say anything about what you say is the best place to eat in America, the Swan Oyster Depot in San Francisco?
Swan Oyster Depot in San Francisco. Peter and I will be heading there directly from the studio.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah.
We would have gone there before the show this morning, except they don't open until 11 today.
We're not the type of magazine or the type of people who feel particularly comfortable or secure in making declarations like that. But I think, as we talk about in that piece, Peter and I were sitting at Swan Oyster Depot, which is a really simple, I think this year is its 100th anniversary, a really simple 15-seat shellfish bar.
It's a counter.
It's a counter.
There's no tables.
Right. Yeah, it's extremely narrow, and it's just run by one family. There's kitsch all over the walls, rubber duckies and, you know,
Niners jerseys
and all sorts of, you know, sports paraphernalia. And it couldn't be simpler, the food they serve, you know, like crab louie and fresh oysters and Anchor Steam beer. And, you know, it's just this iconic restaurant of San Francisco and sort of an iconic restaurant of American food. And Peter and I were sitting there at the counter and wondering how we could somehow get Swan Oyster Depot into our magazine about American food. We just felt obligated to do so. And I think Peter just said to me, like, well, why isn't this just in the magazine? Because it's the best restaurant in America. And, you know, and I couldn't think of a better place or a place I would
Right. And it was like 8:30 in the morning. We had like a beer on the counter in front of us and like two dozen oysters. And it was like, yep, there is no place we would rather be, you know, like right now than right here doing this. And every time I go to Swan, it's that same, like, it's absolutely like heart swelling, strings playing. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe we're here. This is so awesome. And we're like this, this is like, this is, that's the feeling that we're always, you know, I think everybody's looking for when you're in a restaurant. Like, you're in the place and it's taking care of you and you're having a great time. You're having a great time with the person you're with. I remember the first time I went there, I was out on the West Coast and my baby had gotten up at 3 a.m. and we were driving around and she finally fell asleep at like 8 o'clock and we were near Swan. I'm like, let's go. And we brought her in her little carriage and my wife and I just sat there and had oysters and beers for breakfast because we've been up for 5 hours at that point with our baby sleeping on the floor. And it was just like, this is perfect. And every time I go, it's just another perfect experience, even though it's not the only perfect thing they need to do is open the oyster right and like keep things cold. But
it's the sort of place you can feel nostalgic for without ever having been there. It's kind of it captures that feeling we're talking about where, you know, I've never had a pot roast in my life. I didn't grow up eating pot roast. I ate, you know, rice. But I know what pot roast represents. And that's sort of what Swan is. You know, it's you walk in and the things on the walls are the types of things that are on the wall of any chain American restaurant. But they've come from some factory, some like warehouse. And people have tried to recreate this feel in a million different places. But it's, you know, legitimate and genuine at Swan.
Well, it made me think about something that Jonathan said in Peter, in your piece, where he was talking about how everyone's so obsessed with the discovery, you know, discovering the new joint. And it made me think, you know, maybe people were just sometimes looking too hard for these novelty places, that maybe the really great stuff is kind of the stuff that is familiar and just kind of under your nose in some ways.
Well, I mean, I think that there is, you know, one of the things that makes that's different here than it is elsewhere is like, if you go to, let's say, San Sebastian, Spain, like the great places to eat in the Parte Vieja are the same great places that have been there for, you know, 35 or 50 years. As we're in America, there's always upheaval and new places and new things going on, new chances for combination or possibilities, whether it's from, you know, immigrants bringing their traditions here, or, you know, young kids like cooking crazy new food and creating a new experience. But the thing that Swan, I think, does and the best restaurants do is that, and it goes back to what you had asked about authenticity, none of that matters, because what matters is the experience in the place and what they're creating and what you're experiencing. And that's really like the impossible to describe intangible thing about what we're looking for in a restaurant experience. And I, you know, I think we were going at it because it's there and they have that thing there so perfectly that we just wanted to highlight it. But I don't think that it's about new or old or authentic or inauthentic, or it's just about finding the places that make you feel that way.
And I don't think that, you know, trying to find the new place or trying to find some new experiences is wrong or counterintuitive to this ideal of like finding what's nostalgic or what's American. You know, America still has a young food culture. Yeah. And I think that, you know, Peter's daughter is going to grow up with different reference points for what's, you know, American food than Peter did. You know, Peter grew up in Chicago and Chicago style hot dogs are sort of reminiscent of what's home. But, you know, maybe for his daughter, the Sichuan restaurant around the corner in Lower East Side is what will be her memory. And that's sort of the direction of progress, you know, for American food. And that's how it's always been historically in Europe and in Asia when these food cultures have so many differing influences with each passing generation, our reference points for what's, you know, the food of our youth is totally different. And so it's exciting, definitely. Mm-hmm. And finding new places is part of it.
Is part of finding home, and I think that's what, you know, often we're looking for in that restaurant experience.
Let me ask you this finally. I mean, you're sort of at the one-year mark. So what do you think is working so far now, if you look back over the past four issues? Are you coming to some kind of...
We're both definitely working. a lot sometimes. More than I want to. What's working in Lucky Peach?
Yeah.
Well, Peter had said earlier when in talking about Jonathan and Robert that what makes them important as food writers, or what makes them great as food writers, is they bring in this context from outside of the restaurant or outside of the exact ingredients or the taste of the food that they're eating. And I think that's what, when we find success with Lucky Peach, it's usually when we're able to bring in some outside context or some outside influence, or, you know, bring interesting things from outside of like the food sitting in front of you. And that's been our goal essentially for this first year, is just to constantly bring in the artists and photographers and musicians and writers that maybe aren't directly affiliated with food, and have them mingle and with the established great food writers.
It's Chris Ying, editor-in-chief of Lucky Peach magazine, Peter Meehan, co-editor of the magazine. They joined us today from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Guys, thanks a lot for doing this again.
Thanks so much for having us on again, Doug.
Yeah, thanks.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tim Slover. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.